Welcome to the Best of the Left podcast with clips today from Al Franken, Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, and The Young Turks.
The Al Franken Show. Joining us is Jim Norton. He is a producer for the show and been with the show from the very start. Then you took a little absence to write this book.
Yep, a little 6 or 7 months off up in Boston, kind of doing some freelance writing. And then, I put together a book. And
Saving General Washington, the Right-Wing Assault on America's Founding Principles.
Yeah.
And great review in Kirkus. I love the book. And today you had an op-ed piece in the Christian Science Monitor. Now, you don't have to be a Christian Scientist to do that. You worked at the Christian Scientist.
They're very open-minded. I am not, in fact, a Christian Scientist in any way, shape,
I've never understood that. Christian Science.
It's a long story. We can get into the next segment, and I'll unpack the whole thing.
I heard one joke once.
Uh-oh.
A guy in a theater raises his hand and he says, "Is there a Christian Scientist in the house?" And someone says, "Yeah, I am. Why?" He said, "Well, you want to change seats? I'm sitting in a draft." My uncle told me that like 50 years ago. Okay, but that has nothing to do with what you want to talk about today.
It's very tangential.
Your Christian Science Monitor piece is about Guantanamo.
Yeah.
And how our founding fathers would have looked at that.
Yeah, I think one of the things that's gotten lost in the discussion over Guantanamo Bay is just how fundamentally un-American the situation is down there and the existence of this camp is. And one of the things I try to do in my book is go back to the Revolutionary War and say, well, how did this country come together in the first place, and what are the ideas that America was founded on?
Because the right does this all the time. They all, Scalia and those people always talk about original intent.
Exactly.
Right. And what was the original intent in things like habeas corpus and stuff? Well, habeas corpus isn't actually part of the Constitution, is it? But it's
right. It's really become codified in the years since. But
yeah.
That's exactly right. You want to go back, and these were values that served the country, very, very well for a very long time. So I think, when you start floundering and looking for guidance, it's a good place to start. And what was interesting in doing the research on this book is just how decently the founding fathers, Washington and Hamilton and the other ones who were Aaron Burr, who were actually serving in combat.
These guys had a war.
They had a war.
It was called the Revolutionary War?
Often called the Revolutionary War.
The War of Independence?
The War of Independence.
Yes, I remember that.
That's
in history.
And they were very careful about not mistreating British prisoners. They made a point of it. They made it was really kind of a point of pride, and it was smart as a pragmatic policy, because you wanted to keep the public opinion on your side. You wanted to take the moral high ground. You wanted to wear out the British giant. And one way to do that is to act decently, act well, act admirably, and be something people want to emulate and join up with. These guys were also, I think, a little afraid that when they got caught by the British, if they mistreated British troops,
right,
they were going to get, abused in kind, in fact, much worse.
In fact, the British did treat us worse than we treated
the British.
They treated
captured Americans extraordinarily poorly. George Washington in 1775 wrote a letter to his British counterpart, a general named Thomas Gage, and complaining about how American troops who were gravely wounded were being thrown in jails with common criminals and not treated. And Washington was saying, "Look, we've treated your prisoners very well. Not only your officers," he wrote, "and soldiers have been treated with a tenderness due to fellow citizens and brethren, but even those traitors," he said parasites, basically traitors, "whose counsels and aid have deluged their country with blood and have been protected but from the fury of a justly enraged people." Washington's idea was, if you're a prisoner of the Continental Army, you get treated all right. And for a long time, that's been the American norm. In World War II, that worked to our favor to a great extent.
Well, I talked to a West Point professor.
Yeah.
Who told me that in World War II, Nazis would surrender to Americans.
Right.
Much more gladly than they would surrender to other forces. Because in World War I, their fathers had been... Their fathers told them, if you're going to surrender to anyone, surrender right. to the Americans.
No, you had whole German units rushing away from the Russians toward the American lines, hands up, saying, please, you guys capture us because you treat prisoners
but
well.
But also what happens is if they are in combat with us and there's no Russians around, there's just Americans, but they're outnumbered.
Yeah.
There's the difference between fighting to the death,
right,
which means that we get killed,
right,
or they surrender.
Now, John McCain's been really articulate on this point, and one of the things about Guantanamo that I think is really profoundly un-American and would have just cheesed off the founding fathers to know, and is
now you're from Wisconsin.
I'm from Wisconsin.
Okay,
so I do say cheese maybe more often than most people.
Right.
Is what an overreach of executive power this is. How this is sort of a throwback to authoritarian leadership, like you saw under King George. Where the executive says, well, in defiance of any existing laws, I'm going to throw a lot of people in prison and they're going to have no ability to appeal. The evidence won't be reviewed. They'll be maltreated because I've loosened restrictions on mistreatment of prisoners from the Justice Department.
What is the administration policy on charging these people at Guantanamo?
What's
their rationale here?
It's a mess. There's been some military appeals. There's been some civil appeals. I think the ACLU has been kind of not civil, but traditional justice system appeals that the ACLU has been taking up.
But what does the administration say? They say that these are. What do they call them? Enemy combatants.
Enemy combatants, and that term sort of deprives them of any. Traditional sort of habeas corpus rights that they would otherwise enjoy if they were, you know, arrested in the states and they were U.S. citizens.
Mm-hmm.
And part of the rationale for this is some of these guys have information that could save American lives or harm American lives if they aren't deprived of all communication and kind of shut off in a prison. What that argument misses is that some of these guys have been in there for three plus years in some cases. And sure, for the first week or two after you grab someone off the battlefield and you don't know who the guy is.
Well, how many of these guys were grabbed off the battlefield and how many weren't?
The National Journal did a fantastic piece where mm-hmm. they kind of went back and, using court documents, reviewed the status of a lot of these prisoners and found most of them were rounded up by Pakistani bounty hunters
mm-hmm.
or members
That's
of the...
That's my understanding, that
yeah.
a lot of these guys, or Northern Alliance...
Right.
Found and got money for every guy they round up. Well, so if you were a taxi driver
right.
from Karachi, and you're worth just as much as a Taliban.
Well, and what better way to settle a score than to turn someone over to the Americans and collect money for it?
Oh, that's a good way to settle.
It's a great way to settle a score.
I hadn't thought of that.
It's a big win-win, you know, except for the guy who gets shipped off to Gitmo.
That'd be a lose-lose for him.
Yeah, right. He's in bad shape at that point.
Mm.
But that's really one of the most shocking things about this is that when you sit down and you review the cases case by case, as National Journal did, a lot of these guys would be laughed out of any U.S. court. The judges say, how can you possibly justify holding this person? You've got nothing on them. You've got a friend of a friend saying they thought this guy was al-Qaeda.
So this damages us. There was just a new Pew study about public opinion around the world about us, and again, the public opinion...
Well, I mean, that's
throughout the world about the United States,
right?
And that's
completely right. It's not just that we are, in many cases, completely destroying or even taking innocent lives, which I think we should really, as moral people, be worried about. But from a completely pragmatic, from a completely realpolitik perspective, American name has been dragged to the mud, and as long as Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo Bay are what people around the world think of when they think of the United States, I mean, that hurts our ability to organize multinational coalitions. That hurts our ability to criticize anybody who does anything on a human rights front.
Right.
I mean, if you're the dictator of whatever a Stan and you've been torturing people and the U.S. ambassador drops by and says, hey, stop torturing people and, you know, and, yeah. and kicking the crap out of them in prison, you just say, well, what about you guys do that in Abu Ghraib? You understand. You know what it's like to deal with terrorists. You can't give them rights or you die. Well, that's a pretty tight argument right now.
Okay. Well, I'll come back with a better argument later. Bill O'Reilly went down to Guantanamo and made, do you have this, Joel, said this.
Obviously, the military showed us what they wanted us to see. But again, there's absolutely no evidence that I've seen that says any abuse is taking place at Guantanamo Bay.
Now, has he just been just sort of running around that he's seen? Okay.
Yeah, I mean, you might take him very literally. And while Bill O'Reilly was at Guantanamo Bay, no one was being beaten while wearing a hood in the room that he was in. I mean, that's in a very legalistic sense, that could be it. But
evidence that he's seen means that you've read over the last several years, and it's.
I was trying to be fair to Bill O'Reilly, but
why would you want to be? I mean, that's not fair.
No,
when you say there's no evidence that I've seen.
No, it's clearly crazy. I mean, anybody who has taken the time to so much as Google search Guantanamo Bay. The problem is not finding a piece of evidence that points to abuse. It's sorting through the dozens that come down the pipe.
Well, you know, you can Google search things and find wrong information.
Sure.
So the question is, I mean, we know, for example, that FBI agents,
right,
emails that were gotten through FOIA requests by the ACLU,
that's right,
describe horrible abuses,
yeah,
of people lying in their feces, shackled, people put in freezing temperatures, naked.
The Quran being handled roughly and disrespectfully, which is a real issue. You can go to the FBI reports. There's an analyst at the CIA who talked to Seymour Hersh about his visit there, and that was credible and pretty chilling.
Here's something from the Pentagon.
Yeah, that's a good source.
8 soldiers have been punished for offenses ranging from humiliating detainees to physical assault.
Yeah.
That's good that the Pentagon was punishing 8 soldiers, and that might happen, but that's abuse.
That's certainly evidence of abuse.
That's evidence of abuse. So all we're doing here is proving that Bill O'Reilly's Bill O'Reilly.
I think it's more important than that.
Most important thing is proving that Bill O'Reilly is Bill O'Reilly.
I have a secondary, slightly less important point, which is that this is what people on the right wing have been doing because they can't lose the political ground and just admit this is terrible, it's un-American, let's fix this problem. They pretend it doesn't exist. And I was reading the American Spectator today, and its executive editor, Quinn Hillier, had a piece called Resolved, Bush is Right on Iraq. And it was, you know, what you'd expect, the normal cheerleading on Iraq, blah, blah, blah. But he's got this quote in it, and he's kind of talking in passing, and he says, Saddam's torture chambers at Abu Ghraib, real torture, not merely the puerile sexual and cultural embarrassments meted out by a few rogue American soldiers.
Mm-hmm.
People died at Abu Ghraib. There was a guy murdered at Abu Ghraib. No one's been charged in it, but he was in CIA custody.
I remember this. This guy was hooded. He was handcuffed behind his back and hung up.
Yeah.
And died.
He died.
Guys died. And that's the nobody died. You heard Rush say that.
A direct Rush Limbaugh quote. That's not. Yeah. That's precisely what he said.
Nobody died here. What are we talking about?
You know. And it's sad that that's the talking point on that side. And not let's clean this mess up so you know America looks good and frankly is good on this issue.
The sky is yellow and the sun is blue. To quote Scarlett Begonias and Jerry Garcia. Wow. So our founders would be, as I think I said in the in my blurb for your book, would be spinning in their graves enough to provide clean power for
generations of Americans to come.
Gosh darn.
Yeah.
Yeah. Nope. Okay.
So we got to change things.
We will. Scientists tell us there are about 150 days left to the election.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things we need to do is put people in charge who are not going to do this kind of thing and reestablish the moral high ground for the United States. It'd be nice, and which would enhance our power.
It would. It would have a lot of good effects, and one of those good effects would be doing a little less evil in the world.
Yeah, that too. Oh, thanks, Jim. Thanks for being on our side.
Thanks for having me on. Always fun.
Jim Norton, the book, once again, give me the name of the book.
Saving General Washington.
Sorry, Jim.
No worries. The right-wing assault
there
on America's founding principles.
Unbelievable review in Kirkus. That was very impressive.
They were nice to me.
I don't get them. And I'm Al Franken. Huh? You're Jim Norton.
I am just Jim Norton.
From behind these walls, I hear your song. Oh, sweet words, the music that you play lights up my world. The sweetest that ever could it be? I've been touched.
And now the game where we like to ask knowledgeable people about the few things they don't know anything about. Author Calvin Trillin is one of Kansas City's most well-known native sons. He has said that he even created his own version of Kansas City so he could raise his children the same way he was raised, which must have been interesting because he really did it in a brownstone in Greenwich Village. Calvin Trillin, welcome to Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me.
Thank you.
Let's talk about Kansas City, first of all. Here we are. You've been out in the world for quite some time, having grown up here. What kind of image in the world does Kansas City have? If you say, I'm from Kansas City, people expect you to be what?
Well, I find that a lot of people, when I'm talking or something, when the question and answer period comes, say, I'm from Kansas City. They stand up and out, and I always have to say, a lot of people claim to be from Kansas City who aren't, just for the prestige.
Now, I didn't know if I quoted you accurately, that thing that you said about raising your own kids in New York, that they were raised in Kansas City in New York. What does that mean to do that?
Well, it's very easy. You just take a white picket fence and you put it around the brownstone.
Right.
It marks it. You say, this is Kansas City.
And within those confines, what rules apply?
Well, Midwestern rules, and of course the motto of the entire Midwest, which could be on the license plates of all the states, is no big deal.
Don't get a big head about it.
Right.
Don't get too big for your britches.
Right.
You know, we're in the Folly Theater here, a former burlesque house, as I understand it. I wonder if
the answer is no, Roy. I was never in that.
All right.
At least he never bought a ticket. He's willing to go that far. You, of course, are the nation's only deadline poet. You regularly write poetry about the news. In fact, I understand you have a new book out, a collection, your second collection of Bush administration-inspired rhymes.
It's called A Heck of a Job.
Right. Before we go any further, do you, for those who don't know this side of you, do you have a sample for us?
Well, sure. I could read the title poem, which is called Further Words from George W. Bush After He Said to FEMA Chief Michael Brown, Brownie, you're doing a heck of a job. A qualified guy, I wish I had added. Your resume's super, even if padded. We wanted the best to lead FEMA's forces, and who would know more than a man who knows horses? You saw that the storm was more than some showers and sent off a memo in 4 or 5 hours. You found out that life in the dome was not super, and only a day after Anderson Cooper. A heck of a job, you know how to lead them. We hope to award you the Medal of Freedom.
Okay, so...
Mm-hmm.
I have to ask you, they named a new poet laureate this week, and somehow...
Rejected again.
They passed you over.
I mean, I don't understand. This is something like the 14th time in a row I've been rejected.
Is this just the elitism of the Academy? They don't want their poet laureate to be someone who does accessible stuff?
Exactly. I'm glad you said it.
Yeah.
I feel like that actress who always just failed to get the daytime
Susan Lucci.
Susan Lucci.
Yeah, no, you're not, though, because she finally won.
Right.
Oh, well.
I'm not. Right.
That'll never happen.
We need an even more iconic loser for you now.
That's right.
Well, Calvin Trillin, we're pleased to welcome you back to your hometown. We have asked you here, telephonically, to play a game we're calling...
You are the conscience of the Senate and a high-pressure hose of cash back to West Virginia.
In other words, you're Democratic Senator Robert Byrd, who this week set a record and became, with 47 years in office, the longest-serving senator in United States history. Now, we thought we would pay tribute to this great statesman by asking you three questions about him. Get two right, you'll win our prize for one of our listeners, Carl's voice, and their home answering machine. So, Corey, who is author Calvin Trillin playing for?
Lisa Carew Burden of Kansas City.
All right. Here's your first question. Now, it is well known that Robert Byrd was a member of the Ku Klux Klan as a young man. He's a little slip-up. He has repeatedly apologized for ever since. But what's less well known is how much his experience in the Klan changed the course of his life. Was it A, that he met and courted his future wife, Irma, for 2 weeks without ever seeing her with her hood off? Was it B, by winning election to the office of exalted Cyclops, he realized that he could be an effective politician?
C.
Or was it C, a bad asthma attack brought on by a cross-burning made him into a lifelong anti-smoking advocate?
I withdraw my answer. I'll say B.
You're going to say B, that by winning election to the office of exalted Cyclops of the Ku Klux Klan, he realized that he could be an effective politician.
Yeah.
You're right. That's exactly what happened. Byrd was just a shipyard worker when he realized via his electoral success in the Klan that he could convince people to support him. As one of his fellow Klansmen said to him, quote, "You have a talent for leadership, Bob." Okay. You got one right. That was very good. You sort of you came.
I never had any doubts about that.
No, not at all. Now, Mr. Byrd, in his many decades in the Senate, has become known for his mastery of Senate history and rules, and of course, for steering more than $1 billion of taxpayer money back to West Virginia. But he has another remarkable feather in his cap. Is it A, he's issued a CD of himself playing the country fiddle? B, they still call the best player on any West Virginia high school football team the Birdman? Or C, he holds the world record for largest freshwater perch caught with hand tackle?
A.
That he issued a CD of himself playing the fiddle?
Yeah.
You're right, he did. The CD is called U.S. Senator Robert Byrd, Mountain Fiddler. You sounded like you knew that.
I'm doing very well. I was educated in Kansas City.
There you are. Last question. You could go for perfect. Senator Byrd is an accomplished and skilled legislator. In fact, via his mastery of lawmaking, he is personally responsible for which of these things happening? A, each and every federal law enforcement officer in this country now addresses any woman over the age of 15 as ma'am rather than miss. B, cosmetology students in Philadelphia had to spend a day watching lectures by two Supreme Court justices. Or C, Byerly's Cafe in Wheeling, West Virginia will always be exempt from any anti-smoking ordinance.
I like to think it's A. I'm not sure it is, but I'm gonna vote for that one anyway.
You're going to vote for the fact that Robert Byrd, through force of law, now requires that any federal law enforcement officer must address any woman over the age of 15 with the appellation ma'am.
Wow.
Even snotty teenagers. I mean,
Britney Spears is over 15.
I know. So that's your choice. Your choice is A. The answer actually was B, the cosmetology students watching the Supreme Court justice lectures. And not just them. Because of an amendment Byrd slipped into a bill last year, every single school, no matter what they teach, if they receive federal funding, they must instruct their students on the Constitution on September 17th of each year. That's the document's birthday. Another example found by the New York Times, Irene's Myomassology Institute of Massage in Michigan, which quizzed its budding masseurs and masseuses on the Bill of Rights.
Oh, just a little lower. Just a little. There you go.
Yeah. Wait, I'm sorry. So cosmetology students are studying the Supreme Court?
Yes.
Like to give them makeovers or something? Or?
No. Although that would not be such a bad idea. But...
I got that one wrong on purpose because I was brought up to be humble.
There you are. Corey,
no big deal.
No, no big deal. Corey, how did Calvin Trillin do on our quiz?
Calvin Trillin got two right, meaning Lisa Carew Burden gets Carl Castle's voice on her home answering machine.
Very well done. Calvin Trillin is a native Kansas Cityan and author most recently of A Heck of a Job, More of the Bush Administration in Rhyme, now out in paperback. Calvin Trillin, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Economics and international affairs at the place called Princeton University, and is columnist for a thing called the New York Times. He joins us by phone from a place called Princeton, New Jersey. Hi, Paul.
Hi there.
You know, you, I think, were the, if I, maybe I'm wrong here, but I think you were the first columnist after the president landed on the USS Abraham Lincoln in his flight suit to sort of say that it was a mistake to land in the flight suit.
Yeah, I'm not sure if I was really the only guy out there, but yeah, I was.
I mean, you did it as soon as you could. I remember it was the first column out.
Yeah, it was pretty, well, yeah, I mean, basically I was saying I can't believe he did that, and I can't believe that people aren't gagging and generally, you know, this was a deeply un-American moment.
Right, and I remember you saying that. I remember going like, he's right, but wow. And you took a lot of heat for this. And I just, do you mind taking a victory lap on our show?
I mean, I'm always for victory lap.
Okay, this is Gleaves Whitney from the National Review, May 8th, 2003. He goes, more ominously, New York Times columnist Paul Krugman warns that Mr. Bush was breaking an important tradition when he donned a flight suit, that his Top Gun act was scary, that American presidents just don't wear uniforms or military accoutrements. And then the lady goes, that's what galls his detractors, Democrats who distrust the Pentagon, liberals who loathe the military, Bush bashers who still can't get over 2000, election 2000. All these types were on the sidelines during a great American moment. They are not at the victory party on the Lincoln. It slays them that this president has come into his own, that he has grown as a leader in the war on terrorism, that his instincts in Iraq were proven right, and that the majority of Americans are behind him. The image on the carrier conveys all that is strong and hopeful and confident in the man.
Yep. Boy, yeah.
We tried to get
declarations of victory and all that. You know, and the thing was, you know, the business of, you know, being, you're against the troops if you are, you hate the military if you think that, you know, the president, who didn't actually, among other things, serve in a war, shouldn't dress up as one of them. Amazing stuff.
Well, you know, we tried to get Gleaves Whitney to come on and sort of defend what he wrote there, but we couldn't get him.
Yeah, no, the thing was about, you know, even then, I mean, in fact, if you were paying attention, even on Mission Accomplished Day, it was pretty clear that this wasn't, you know, being able to scatter
a fourth world army is not the same thing as success in what they were trying to do. And, well, the whole thing. It's just, it's amazing.
You know, he kind of, in a way, in the last press conference with Blair, where he said, maybe I shouldn't have said bring it on, and maybe I shouldn't have said wanted dead or alive. I think he was kind of addressing this whole thing.
Yeah, but it's, you know, Bush's version of an apology is, I'm sorry that you were disturbed by what you thought I said. You know, he never actually says, I was wrong.
Oh, no. It sent the wrong message. I've learned a lot about expressing myself in a more sophisticated manner.
Yeah, I can just, to go a little over the line here, I can just imagine that, husband and wife arguments in this White House must be along the lines of, I'm sorry that you feel that way. I mean, this is the kind of person you really don't want as a spouse or as a president.
Well, no, but that's a fair thing to say in a spousal argument. I'm sorry you feel that way. Okay, well, let's not get into our personal lives. Let's get into Bush's. No, let's get into, you wrote a column, The Some Who Argument.
Yeah.
Which is basically about, well, for example, the Washington Times said some Democrats call the killing of Zarqawi a stunt.
Yeah, and there were in fact no Democrats quoted in the article saying that, and
no one said it.
That's right. No one said it.
Then, more importantly, not in the article, but just no one said it.
That's right. So I was harking back to this wonderful old Russell Baker article from the Vietnam era, where some of the same thing happened, where there were a lot of denunciations of those who, as in those who snivel and sneer at America. And these days we've got the some, especially some Democrats, and it's this entirely mythical notion of that there's this large core within the Democratic Party of people who think that America is evil and hate the troops. And it's amazing. I mean, it's, of course, it's straw men, but what's amazing is how widespread it is, and it's coming even from some Democrats who are still trying to stake out their position as being more hawkish than everybody else.
Well, let's go over some of these. One you brought up that is hilarious is President Bush in 2003 saying, some say, well, maybe the recession should have been deeper.
Yes. What he was saying was, you know, there are some people who don't approve of my tax cuts, and it's really pretty vile. I mean, it's saying, you know, if you didn't approve of my tax cuts, it's because you wanted a deeper recession, whereas those of us who didn't approve of his tax cuts actually said, hey, you know, these are a really lousy recession-fighting measure, and you should be doing something else. And so, but that's actually quite typical. And by the way, that was standard. It was not just Bush, but the whole Republican leadership. If you said, you know, why are you cutting taxes for rich people? Why not put money into the hands of people who actually need it and would actually spend it? They'd say, do you actually want a recession? And, you know, it's just this. It wasn't actually out of character. But now Bush was, you know, pretending that there were actually people saying that. Yes.
Okay, I want to play a couple tapes of people setting up straw men. One is Bush, and get your reaction to it. This is one of my favorites of this presidency. Play the Bush one.
You know, there's a lot of people in the world who don't believe that that people whose skin color may not be the same as ours can be free, can self-govern. I reject that. I reject that strongly. I believe that people who practice the Muslim faith can self-govern. I believe that people whose skins aren't necessarily, you know, are a different color than white can self-govern.
Okay, who says that, like, for example, Turkey is like a government, isn't it?
yeah.
Aren't we even thinking of bringing Turkey into, like, the European Union, or no, we aren't. The Europeans are.
The Europeans are having a little trouble deciding whether they're really ready to do that. But
I understand that, but no one is saying this. No one is saying that people different than our color. And by the way, what color are we? Are we a color?
Yeah, all right. I can actually find you. I can find you some quotes of people saying that people who don't have the same skin color as any rate as you and me can't.
But they aren't.
But it's mostly actually people from the I can find you a bunch of articles in the National Review from the 1950s saying that about the U.S. South and why we need to keep Jim Crow. But I can't actually...
Okay, yeah, but those are more tend to be right-wing people,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, that's right. I don't think you can find a I don't think you can find a Bush basher who thinks that people with a different skin color can't have democracies.
Right. Okay, now here's one that Condi Rice said a couple weeks ago, and she's on Russert, and Russert says, well, you know, why do people, are they turning against the war? And she says, well, they're seeing people killed every day. And he said, yeah, but also they're seeing a lot of mistakes that we've made. And she said, well, yeah, we've made, you know, some mistakes get made on these kind of things, but there were a lot of mistakes we didn't make. And then she does one of these, there are those who said things, and I want you to hear this and react to it.
There were those who said the Iraqis will really never be able to do this. Let's go in with a huge footprint and do leave nothing to the Iraqis.
Oh, boy.
Okay.
That wasn't, right. That's an amazing way to take a colossal error and spin it as that's because we're good people and the people who wanted us to do it right are bad people. Yeah, well, of course, the point there was... experience shows that if you're going to move in and occupy a place, you want to have a lot of boots on the ground just for security.
Now, did you hear anyone like Shinseki or Zinni or anybody who was arguing that we should send in a lot of troops? Did you hear any of them say that the reason for that was that the Iraqis will never really be able to do this, that we should leave nothing to the Iraqis? Or did you hear them say, we need this many troops in order to maintain order, to seal off the borders, et cetera?
Yeah, this is a complete, this is an imaginary foe, as usual, and there was nothing like that. It's great. I mean, if you want to explain how it is that we got into this, or why the people who were for this gigantic mistake were actually more right than the people who had the good sense to be against it, you say, well, the people who were against it for discreditable reasons.
Right.
And that's actually very common right now. As you know, as I wrote in that The Times a few days ago, there's still this view in Washington that you're not credible on national security unless you were wrong about Iraq.
Yeah, in other words, it's a badge of honor to have been wrong.
That's right. Didn't Chalabi say that?
Huh?
Ahmed Chalabi, the man that...
He said a heroic error or something?
I think he said we are heroes in error, yes.
Heroes in error, yeah. But you know what I think this does? I really think this discredits her and discredits them if people are just listening. Because for her to make, first of all, she's saying right now, she's saying in this quote that we did send enough troops, which is just crazy.
Yeah. Well, no, I could interpret it as, well, you know, because we are such good, fine people, we believed that the Iraqis could take care of it and didn't need our help in providing initial security.
No, but this was under a list of mistakes they didn't make.
Right. Well, yeah, I guess that's right. You're saying that it would have been a mistake. It would have been a mistake to have enough troops there to prevent the looting and demolition.
That's exactly what she's saying. Yep. That's what she's saying.
Oh, there we go.
Drink a baby down. Are you in or out? Leave your things behind. Cause it's all going off without you. Excuse me.
Don, welcome to our show. Now you're going to start us off with Who's Corey This Time. Corey Flintoff, filling in for Carl Castle, is going to reenact for you three quotes from the week's news. Of course, if you can correctly identify or explain just two of them, you will win our prize, Carl Castle's Voice, on your home answering machine.
Sounds good.
Doesn't it? All
right. Sounds great.
Okay, fine. That's more like it. Now we can go. Here's your first quote.
They should have known he was up to something when Bush told Camp David Guest, I'm going to read.
Now, that was the Hotline political newsletter, suggesting that President Bush's cabinet should have figured out that he was really going to go where?
I would have to say Iraq.
Exactly right, yes. There has been so much good news out of Iraq that the president decided to go join the party himself. Of course, the reason it was done in absolute secrecy with massive military protection was just because the president doesn't want to be a bother. They're all watching the World Cup, you know, let them just sneak in. In fact, the new Iraqi prime minister wasn't told who he was going to meet until just before the president walked into the room, which makes wonder, what did he think? Prime Minister Maliki, when he saw who it was, did he think something like, wait a minute, not even he could get this lost? Or did he just, like, start immediately trying to stuff himself into the president's luggage?
I'm still confused. I'm sorry, was he going over there to borrow a book? I'm confused. He was going to read.
Yeah, he told the captain, he said, well, I'm going to go read now.
Oh, okay.
And he gave him a big wink and walked into Marine One, and they took him off to the airport, and the next thing you know, they're in the green zone.
Yeah, go read now. People who do read don't say things like that, do they? Supposed to say, I'm going to think I'll curl up with a good book. Or something.
Yeah, right.
I will go read now. And I will not move my lips.
Speaking of going to Iraq, here's your next quote.
He has previous jihadi experience and a deep foot in the pool of knowledge.
That's how Al-Qaeda in Iraq announced its new hire, a man who apparently impressed them with his resume. This man will take the place of whom?
The guy who got murdered. Al-Zarqawi.
Yes, say it again.
Al-Zarqawi.
Close enough. It's Zarqawi.
Ding, ding, ding.
Yeah. Al-Zarqawi, of course, that 500-pound bomb may have been bad news for Zarqawi, but it was a career opportunity for one Abu Hamza al-Muhajir, also known as Abu Ayyub al-Masri. According to Al-Qaeda in Iraq websites, this guy's now in charge. Now, those, of course, are not his real name. We don't know his real name. Those are his nom de guerre, or noms de guerre, I guess.
Yeah.
And they have been translated, respectively, the first one as, quote, the guy who was slowest out of the room when we announced the vacancy. The second one, Abu Ayyub al-Masri, means, quote, he who you should stay 600 yards away from minimum if you want to keep your dates connected to your palm tree, if you know what I mean, unquote. All right, very good. Here is your last quote.
There's still life in these old bones yet, and I certainly couldn't miss it.
Now, that was Maria Müller, a 94-year-old German woman who had been declared dead by her doctor, but who then leapt up and demanded to know the latest news from what sporting event?
The World Cup.
Yes, indeed. Apparently, World Cup mania has the power to resurrect the dead. In news this week, from what we are assured repeatedly is the world's biggest sporting event, Germany renewed its friendly rivalry with neighbor Poland in a match that ended with Germany not only beating the Poles, but annexing them. Britain played Trinidad and Tobago, beating Trinidad, but just tying Tobago. And the U.S. team got its blue and white shorts handed to them by the Czech Republic. Oh, yeah, some Czech fans here, I know. In fact, at the end of the game, the U.S. team was reduced to asking permission to just throw the ball.
When people think I'm dead, I hope they won't check by playing soccer to me. It won't be enough.
No. What would be enough to bring you back from the dead, Rod?
Well, if somebody said, you want to go read, I might perk up then.
So, have you guys been following the first week of the World Cup at all?
No.
Not a thing, huh?
No, not a thing.
Yeah, watching.
I played soccer once when I was much younger, and every time I was about to kick the ball, somebody else kicked it.
And what's up with that?
Oh,
yeah. It seems hardly fair.
I
can't watch it. Every time I watch it, I think I just have that sensation of somebody kicking a ball away.
Away from you, yeah.
With my foot back, you know, one foot deep in the pool of knowledge and the other one.
Right.
Back.
When I wake up, well, I know I'm going to be the man who wakes up next to you. When I go out, yeah, I know I'm gonna be the man who goes along with you. If I get drunk, well, I know I'm gonna be the man who gets drunk next to you. And if I haver, yeah, I know I'm gonna be the man who's havering to you. But I will walk 500 miles.
Dave in Wyoming is joining us now online, too. Dave, how are you? Welcome to the Young Turks.
How are you?
Good. What's going on?
What do you mean by that? We're neocons there. I'm missing that for some reason.
Sure. They're this philosophical group called the neoconservatives, sometimes shortened to neocons, and sometimes we shorten it to neoclowns. They believe in regime change throughout the Middle East to help Israel, I mean the U.S., for weapons of mass destruction or perhaps oil and global domination. And they wrote this whole thing even before the Bush administration got involved, got elected, a project for a new American century where they told people that they would invade Iraq, then Iran, et cetera, et cetera. And that's what they're trying to do. And
there's like 80 of them in the world, and they have wielded an amazing influence on American foreign policy since September 11th. And actually what Robert was talking about was in the Project for a New American Century, which is published, and it's not a secret. They talk about the need for a Pearl Harbor-like event that will enable us to sort of take on the actions that would enable us to sort of have the regime change that they seek throughout the Middle East.
By the way, the people who signed that document are Dick Cheney, Don Rumsfeld, Paul Wolfowitz, Doug Feith, all the people who brought you to Iraq War.
I was going to say Jeb Bush was included.
Lynn Cheney as well. So go ahead, Dave.
Okay, my only comment, and I'll listen for your words after, is you guys are the most ignorant fucks in.
All right. Well,
awesome.
That's a rather ironic comment, if you ask me. But yeah,
was this the same guy that started out so polite about the neocons?
Yeah. No. He's like, so what the hell's a neocon anyway? So we explain to him. Oh yeah, you're ignorant. Dave, who doesn't love you, man? Because you make our job so easy.
You're good people. You're making the country proud, Dave. Thank you.
Dave, what's a redneck?
This is Jill Pike from the Young Turks, and you're listening to us on the Best of the Left podcast. Catch the entire show live at theyoungturks.com.
March 8th, 2006. Hey, Paul. Thanks for playing the promo on your show. I definitely saw a little boost in the numbers. I must say, though, I was surprised that you didn't bother to mention that you helped inspire the idea for the show. You didn't forget that, did you? Have a good one. Jay. Jay. Shit. When was that? Paul, I mentioned it in the first email I sent you about the show. I said that a big part of the idea I got was from when you talked on your show about, quote, what if somebody created an RSS feed and put in a bunch of content that they liked? Then, if you trusted that person's taste, you could just subscribe to their feed and get all that content, unquote. Or something to that effect. And that's what gave me the idea for the Best of the Left. Jay. Oh, wow. Did you tell me that before? That's awesome. I think I'll have to mention that on the next show. Our sponsorship with HBO was only for 4 shows anyways. Paul. Hey, Paul. As I've said before, I really do listen to about 7 hours of podcasts each day. Unfortunately, I still fall behind on non-political shows. Last time I emailed you to thank you for the plug, I hadn't even heard your most recent show, and had no idea that you played my promo twice and actually talked about it in the show. You guys are too good to me. Maybe one day I will actually have the status to return the favor. Jay. Haha. We'll hold you to that, Jay. Since you're in promotion mode, do you see a maximum size you can reach on the horizon? That is, before you start getting cease and desist letters from Sirius and Air America? I'm just wondering. I don't know that those two wouldn't just look at your show as more free promotion for their paid services. Paul. After looking into the murky waters of fair use copyright law, I have loosely determined that a lawsuit against me wouldn't be a very strong case, especially because I'm not trying to make any money off of them. Yet. I don't think they would try it anyways, seeing as I'm trying to boost their ratings and not compete with them. I have actually already been in talks with the kind folks over at the Young Turks, and they really like the idea of my show. Even though they don't feel threatened by me, I have offered them a preemptive olive branch by giving them a few seconds of free ad time on the show a couple of days per week. So now they're in the process of producing a couple of short spots for me to run. If all that goes well, I plan to make the same offer to Air America. I would rather they know who I was and know I'm on their side than to have them find me and think I'm a competitor. By the way, I don't blame you for not being able to stop talking about wasting time at work. I can't get enough of those guys. They have the exact sense of humor that I have been using for years to baffle anyone who will listen. Have you checked out pbump.net or the fake fact of the day? That stuff's genius. Jay.
If you guys go to hippiesympathizer.com, one of the things I will play at the end of the show today is a promo from our friend Jay. And he does a new show called The Best of the Left podcast. And I just emailed him and I said, like, hey, Jay, I'm like listening to these shows constantly. I can't believe how hard you work, you know, because he's putting like one up every day. But it's basically like the best of lefty radio shows. It's like he'll cut out like Rachel Maddow.
Yeah, so he's got to listen to like 9 hours of shows all day long.
Yeah, and apparently he's able to do that. So
yeah,
wow. But it's really awesome. Yeah,
cool. Check it out.
So anyway.
All right, I think I'll take over because this is like... Ooh.
And with those inspiring and heartfelt words, an audience was born.
Why listen to the PK and Jay show?
Well, did you ever try to your without it first?
Why listen to the PK and Jay show?
Because one guy thinks that Jeanette's voice is the sexiest in podcasting.
Why listen to the PK and Jay show?
Because the PK and Jay show is not watered down, corporation approved, mass produced, Clear Channel crap that makes you want to eat your shirt.
PK and Jay.
As mentally defective as I am.
You know, somebody in my car, but I think it's okay. I tasted it and it's deer.
Ha ha.
Ha ha. This is ridiculous.
This madness has got to stop.
This has got to stop.
I might as well.
They're going to get their bleached.
I can't wait till your parents hear this show.
What? Somebody's bound to be offended. So,
I would definitely have sex with a doll just for just
shits and giggles.
Yeah. But as far as owning one...
You heard it here first. What's your rap?
Yeah, what is your rap?
You know...
What's your strategy?
That's a good question. I may need some help on that one.
The rap is no rap at all.
Unless you totally suck.
Unless you totally suck. Come on. If you totally suck, just don't even get out of bed tomorrow.
Where's the penis?
It only 3 mpgs. You think the Mongoloid doesn't get great gas mileage? But who the hell cares? This car is fantastically enormous. Hummer and Escalade owners, eat your hearts out.
It's time to prank phone call our family and friends. Prank phone call our family and friends.
I'm going to listen to it some more too.
Check out the PK and Jay Show. www.pkandjshow.com.
So now that you've heard how it all got started, go to the PK and Jay show and shower Paul and Jeanette with all of your thanks and praise for inspiring the Best of the Left podcast that you love so dearly. I am not kidding when I say that without them, I don't think that this show would exist. I fully endorse their show. It's one of the few that I actually managed to keep up on. And I hope that you will check them out and love them as much as so many others already do. So to Paul and Jeanette of PK&J, consider yourselves repaid. Have a good one, everybody.